Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is episode 313. We're going to talk about excess cortisol or hypercortisolism. And to help us do that, we have the second most handsome doctor in North America. That's Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, doing all right. And another hospital stretch and had an exciting day taking care of, I think, 17 sick inpatients and did a lot of teaching, did some ultrasound, did a whole bunch of cool stuff today. So
if you had to predict your cortisol levels right now, if you had to estimate them, do you think they're like baseline? Do you think they're elevated? Do you think you're turned up? Like what's going on?
Well, not terribly elevated. I did just finish a bit of a workout. So whatever effect that might have, it's also late afternoon, early evening. So that has a little bit of a dip to it. So, you know, probably all comes out in the wash and doesn't really matter.
I mean, honestly, yeah, let's just shut down the podcast. That's it. That's it. That's all you need to know. How long since you finished your workout? I could predict this.
About 20 minutes.
Right now, it's probably still above baseline when you like prior to thinking about starting. Although when you thought about starting, exercise, it went up. But about 90 minutes, you're going to be back to baseline. And then tonight, here's the cool part. And we'll talk about this more when we talk about exercise. His effect on cortisol, it's going to be lower than if you were an insufficiently active individual. It's like a compensatory response in those who are well-trained. And I think we can all agree that you're well-trained. So, you know, make sure you do that next time on teaching rounds when you get somebody with a cortisol aberration. Before we get into this podcast, we do have a mystery case. I wanted to make a few announcements. First up is a new offering that we have. Now, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that we started this podcast with the goal to make it a comprehensive, evidence-based resource for topics relating to health, exercise, medical science, behavior change, and more. While there's no shortage of podcasters in this space, you guys are all aware of that, only a select few are putting out information you can trust. And over the past 300 plus episodes or so, Dr. Baraki and I have tried our best to be one of your go-to resources for health information. But now, with your help, we want to do more. Starting October 1st, we're launching Barbell Medicine Plus so that we can expand what we're doing on the podcast, the website, and beyond. Currently, each episode we do requires many hours doing research, creating an outline, recording, editing, and getting everything ready to publish. We do this ourselves because we're passionate about bridging the gap between modern medicine and strength and conditioning, but we think we can do better. With your additional support, With your additional support of the new Plus podcast, we'd be able to dedicate time to edit the transcripts from each episode because the AI is not quite up to speed with medical or training-related jargon just yet. And we'd also like to publish executive summaries and articles for each episode in order to make things easier to understand and easier to reference or share in the future. Other things on the wish list include hiring a professional to help us with audio quality and release video versions of the podcast. With the support of Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers, we think we could do all this and more. So if you subscribe, what do you get? Well, first things first, we're excited to offer a completely ad-free episode to subscribers. Next, each episode will feature an executive summary and article, a full transcript, and a video version of every podcast that we have videos for. So we're chewing through the library right now to create all of those things for you guys. And we're also psyched to launch a brand new feature where subscribers will have access to a private forum to ask questions of Dr. Baraki and I, which we'll answer in an exclusive subscriber-only monthly Ask Me Anything or AMA episode. And finally, we'll also be publishing other exclusive content for Plus members throughout the year. So if you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus subscriber, mark your calendars for October 1st. We'll be launching then, and we'd love to have your support. As far as other announcements go, we still do have that live in-person pain and rehab seminar coming up in a few short weeks in Atlanta. So our pain and rehab staff will be out there doing an in-person seminar. It is worth CEUs if you're a physical therapist. And likely if you're a personal trainer, you can apply these to your personal training cert. Are you going to be in Atlanta? I didn't think you had any plans to go there, Dr. B, but I was, you know.
I've been able to make it to a few of these before. I think that is unlikely to be possible for me this year.
You've been to a bunch of them, and it's not like you're just going there to hang out and just like sit in the back and, you know, drink.
Yeah, I participate, and I actually helped teach the one that was in Miami last January, and I went to the one in Reno and attended and kind of participated and hung out with the other attendees and answered questions and things like that were fired my way. So yeah, it's a good experience.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of feedback from people who've gone to multiple ones, and they always say the same thing. It's like, I learned so much the next time that I went to one of these things. And it's kind of like, we know that it's a lot of information. And it's kind of like, yeah, if you were already an expert, I don't know that you would necessarily show up unless you needed the CEUs, for example. But even the people that I view as, yeah, you're definitely an expert in the space, or at least you should be, they seem to get a lot out of it. So if that's you, if you're a personal trainer and you have clients, most likely one or more of them is going to have an injury at some point. So being up on that will be helpful. If you're a physical therapist and you're trying to figure out how to incorporate some more evidence-based sort of training stuff in your practice, that will be useful. And then if you're a strength enthusiast, unfortunately, it's highly likely that you're going to have an injury yourself, and this may be beneficial for you. So yeah, it's a 2-day live in-person seminar coming up in Atlanta in a few weeks. Linked all of that in the show notes below. Now, before we get into the main part of this podcast, which again is on elevated cortisol levels, we do have a mystery case. People seem to love the mystery case. Are you surprised by this, Austin?
I mean, not really. I don't know that I had given it as much thought when we started doing it. When we started doing it, it was more like interesting and fun for me. But when I think about it, I'm like, well, medical dramas and all that kind of stuff is super popular on TV. People like to watch this stuff. So maybe that's feeding a little bit of that itch, plus the selection bias of our audience that are generally going to be maybe a little bit more interested in this kind of thing. But fun for me, interesting for them. Win-win.
Yeah. Can you imagine if we had like a sound engineer and like a, you know, a producer who wasn't just me, and like, you know, they wrote a whole script and we, you know, made this a drama and we could have drops and music and all sorts of stuff. We'd just be telling stories. I don't know. Maybe that's a pipe dream, but, you know, as is my custom, I have to predict whether or not you're going to get this. I think you're going to get it. I'm flipping the script. I think you're going to get it. This is the first time that I've predicted that you're going to get it. I finally come around. Like, you know, I'm batting zero right now. And so if you don't get it this time, I'm going to be upset personally. I
mean, sometimes that happens, you know?
Yeah, that's true. If you want to play along at home, I will cue you guys up at the end of every section where I ask Dr. Baraki what his thoughts are. So if you want to play along at home, press pause. Don't click off the podcast, but press pause. Come up with your own sort of, you know, differential diagnosis, a list of things it could be and why, so you can kind of think your way through this. And I suspect that would likely help learning, but that's more speculation than any sort of evidence-based thing in this particular setting. So without any further ado, let's get into the mystery case. It's a 55-year-old woman presents to the emergency department with a 4-day history of severe muscle pain and weakness associated with lightheadedness and dark-colored urine. She says that before she had these symptoms, she had been packing up her house, preparing to move, which she was able to do just fine. Afterwards, her muscles became increasingly painful and weak, now making it difficult to walk or even get out of bed without assistance. She required EMS help to remove her from her house and bring her to the hospital. She denies any recent trauma or illness. She does have a past medical history that's significant for a few things. First off, 9 years ago, she had rhabdomyolysis. Her CK at the time was 10,000. That required a brief admission for hydration. She also has been diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis and currently takes levothyroxine to treat that. She also has chronic low back pain, and she's on methadone for that. And she has major depressive disorder, and she's on sertraline for that. It's currently well managed. So before we go on to any sort of exam or clinical laboratory findings, Austin, you want to summarize the patient and give your sort of initial thoughts?
Sure. 55-year-old woman who has a history of rhabdo in the past, as well as Hashimoto's thyroiditis, coming in with a few days, 4 days of muscle pain, weakness, and dark urine. This seemed to onset after doing some light housework. And so the reason I'm framing it that way, just a few things I guess I would point out. The lightheadedness, I'm not paying much attention to at this point. It is unlikely to be very diagnostically useful, especially at this stage of the game. It's not a very specific symptom that clues me into something. It doesn't seem to be like the focal point of this case, the most concerning thing, or basically the symptom with the narrowest differential diagnosis. That's usually where we try to put our focus. And so if I compare muscle pain, muscle weakness, or dark urine, they all have much fewer possibilities of the things that can cause it compared with lightheadedness. So I'm setting that aside. I'm also pointing out that this happened in the setting of some light housework, kind of to emphasize the idea that this, you know, to the extent that this is also obviously evocative of another recurrent episode of rhabdomyolysis as my, you know, initial gut, you know, reaction, it's seemingly disproportionate to the amount of exertion that, you know, led to it. And so that itself is worth pointing out because, you know, if I recently had a patient just last week, actually, who I admitted for exertional rhabdomyolysis, and he did something, I forget what it was called, like a gladiator challenge or something like that. And it was basically an hour divided into 20-minute chunks. It was 20 minutes of squats, 20 minutes of bench press, 20 minutes of deadlifts. And then at the end, it was some AMRAP pull-ups. I don't know how they selected the weight. This patient was in early middle age, I'll put it that way, just to be as vague as possible, underprepared for this task. And so he was admitted with exertional rhabdomyolysis with a CK of well over 100,000. And I said, yeah, that tracks. I buy that. That fully explains your syndrome, right? And I didn't question it. Here we have a scenario where this patient has what could be, we're headed towards that sort of a, you know, it's evocative of that syndrome with a disproportionate, you know, exertion before it and this background history of having rhabdo in the past. So that's kind of raising my antenna a little bit. But just to back up even further, if I'm just looking at a patient with muscle pain and weakness in general, we've done this kind of a framework, I guess, before. Weakness, you know, I pay attention to, is it in one particular area or is it diffuse, generalized? And that helps me to narrow down, is this more neurologic weakness or is this more something like metabolic, you know, issues leading to weakness, infections leading to weakness, electrolyte problems, medicines, drugs, toxins, things like that, that would affect everywhere instead of a neurologic problem that would affect just one, you know, location potentially. The muscle pain is not something we typically see in neurologic causes of weakness outside of things like sciatica, radicular pain, but something like weakness from a stroke, you don't usually get pain in that extremity. So the pain and the weakness together is kind of pushing me a little bit further out to the periphery compared with brain and spinal cord. I'm thinking more like nerves and muscles and things like that. When we combine all of that with the dark urine, now I'm even more suspicious of this being a primary muscle problem like rhabdomyolysis or some kind of myopathy, myositis, that general umbrella category of conditions. Now, if I'm just taking the dark urine by itself, because we like to do this exercise where we take each symptom, think about what could cause it and kind of Venn diagram them a little bit, right? And so dark urine can happen when your urine's just concentrated, when you haven't drank enough. It can get dark when there's blood in your urine, which can come from a lot of different causes. It can come from other pigmented substances like bilirubin and things like that that can end up in your urine. It can happen from certain outside substances like coming from food. People eat beets, their urine turns red, or from certain medications that can turn your urine dark orange or various colors, for example. So there's, you know, this idea of dark urine can be concentrated, it can be endogenous pigments from within your body, it can be exogenous pigments from outside your body. And when we see dark urine in the setting of rhabdo, that would be an example of an endogenous pigment, a pigmented thing that's making the urine dark that's coming from within your body, coming from the muscle, which in this case nicely overlaps with this presenting syndrome of muscle pain and weakness. So at this stage, with that set of symptoms, again, paying not a ton of attention to the lightheadedness so far, and with the background history, she's had rhabdo in the past, I'm concerned about just maybe an underlying muscle disorder, unless she gives me a much more clear history of significant exertion with both of these episodes. I'm wondering if, well, if you're getting rhabdo after not a lot of exertion, right, the possibilities are you're just so deconditioned and even doing a little bit of exertion is putting you into rhabdo, which really still shouldn't happen. Or you have some kind of chronic, you know, myopathy, some sort of long-term muscle disorder that is predisposing you such that it takes less activity or exertion to trigger a syndrome like this. I think it's probably too early for me to speculate as far as all the possible myopathies that could be going on. And I've been talking long enough, so I'll pause for now and see what we get next.
I like that. Yeah, the duration limited response. You're just like, well, I've done enough. Okay, fair enough. All right. So now that our listeners have rejoined us after they did their own differential, I assume to the same degree that you were able to do. Yes, that's right. Let's get into the physical exam and some initial laboratory findings. So first up, vital signs are significant for a blood pressure 90 over 55, but otherwise her vital signs are unremarkable. The patient is seen in bed and she does appear to be in pain. She moves very little throughout the exam. She is alert and oriented and responds appropriately. However, she is markedly weak with strength testing. Your intern reports that it's 3 out of 5. Passive range of motion is limited due to pain, and proximal muscles of the upper and lower extremities are tender to palpation. She has no deformities on exam, no bruising, no skin changes are noted. Pulses are intact and normal. The laboratory labs were sent initially while in the ED, and they were significant for a creatine kinase, a CK level to 62,000. Her liver function tests were also elevated. So ALT was 153, AST was 3,800, and her GGT was elevated to 204. Those are all just liver function tests. And if you just wanted to interpret that, yeah, they're real high. TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, was also high at 4.2, although she had a normal free T4. Complete blood count, electrolytes, and renal function was otherwise normal. So before we go any further, and if you're listening at home, this is the time to pause again to generate some additional thoughts. Austin, do you have any additional thoughts?
Yeah. I'm curious, you didn't give me a creatinine. I'm going to say maybe it's okay in
yes.
Your situation. Okay, cool. The thing that we would worry about the most here. So starting with her vital signs, that blood pressure is certainly on the low side among, you know, all comers, but some patients can live at that level. So I'd be most interested in getting a sense of, you know, does she tend to live on the low end of blood pressure or not? I don't see she's on any blood pressure medicines. And I don't really think of any of the medicines that she's on as having a major blood pressure lowering effect. It is interesting that her blood pressure is this low despite being in that much pain. Usually you'd expect it to be a little bit higher, right? So I'm thinking about what's my usual thought process around if this does represent low blood pressure or hypotension, what could lead to something like that. The first and most common thing is people having hypovolemia, not enough blood volume. For example, if they're not eating or drinking enough, vomiting, diarrhea, you know, things like that. But other causes can certainly cause this that would be more dangerous, more life-threatening. Problems with your heart, with your cardiovascular system, severe infections, adrenal-related issues, medications, toxins, and certain other very dangerous things that I don't think are going on right now, like a gigantic pulmonary embolism or something like that. So I'm just kind of noting that blood pressure. I'd want to dig into her background a little bit more and do some assessment to get a sense of why is that going on right now and how worried should I be. The exam just confirms what she already told us was going on when she came in. She has pain, she has weakness due to pain, but nothing else that's jumping out at us as, you know, sending us in a different direction than we were already headed on her exam. And then on labs, it does indeed confirm our suspicion that she's having some active muscle breakdown leading to the release of creatine kinase, or that CK, from her muscle. And similarly, even though those enzymes that you mentioned, alanine, transaminase, ALT, AST, and GGT are classically categorized as quote-unquote liver function tests, those enzymes are also found in various other tissues, including muscle, and AST to a greater extent is found in muscle. And so that's why I'm not as concerned about primary liver dysfunction here. I'd want to know some other tests to get a sense of how likely is it that she has liver issues going on, like a bilirubin or an INR. But I think it's more likely that all of that stuff is just getting released from her muscle, just like the CK is. The TSH is fine. I'm not, that's even though it might flag as high in the case report or something, that's not actually terribly high or certainly concerning enough to be contributing to this syndrome. So we've confirmed that she has rhabdomyolysis, and this seems to be acute rhabdomyolysis based on the duration of symptoms and how she's coming in. The question though is why? And there are various types of rhabdomyolysis. I mentioned earlier the first kind of branch point that I think of rhabdo in terms of, is it exertional or non-exertional? Is it adequately and fully explained by some exercise-related activity or exertional activity? And I'm not really feeling that sense right here, right? That may have precipitated it, but there's some other predisposing factor. And other things that can predispose to this is patients who have some kind of an underlying myopathy, which can happen due to, for example, thyroid disorders, adrenal disorders related to cortisol, for example. Other issues can emerge due to toxic myopathies. So certain drugs can impact the muscle. I didn't see any drugs on her medication list that would cause this. Supplements would fall in that category too. I'd be asking about that kind of thing. Crush injuries, trauma can lead to rhabdomyolysis when patients sometimes, you know, I've seen elderly patients who fall and they've been lying on the ground for 12, 18, 24 hours before somebody finds them. That can lead to rhabdomyolysis. Certain electrolyte issues like severely low phosphorus, severe potassium derangements can lead to rhabdomyolysis. So basically, I'm thinking of endocrine-related issues, hormone issues, toxic issues like from meds and supplements, other metabolic issues like some of these electrolyte things. And then there can be autoimmune or inflammatory issues that can basically be kind of smoldering, impacting the muscle, and then that can kind of be triggered when somebody does have some exertion. The last category, and one that most physicians are probably not dealing with on a regular basis or thinking about terribly often is some kind of a metabolic or a mitochondrial myopathy, which would emerge usually much earlier in life. Patient, you know, children, adolescents, people in their, you know, teen years, 20s would be having like recurrent episodes of rhabdo after like anything. And that's because they have like a mitochondrial disease to where their muscles cannot produce enough energy to do what they do. And so they self-destruct when they exercise, basically. So there's even more, you know, you're talking to an internist here, so I could talk all day about this stuff. But again, I will hold off there. And so my next, you know, course of action is to take more history, send off some testing for some of those other variables, potentially, you know, think about whether I should send autoimmune antibody things, whether that's worth imaging or biopsying a muscle potentially, especially if just giving her some routine fluid hydration doesn't resolve this syndrome on its own.
Yeah. You know, just before we go any further, when you see like a second, you know, time that somebody had rhabdomyolysis that maybe is not well explained, does that trigger like automatically you're getting a workup, or maybe from the first, you know, initial time that this person presented, in this case 9 years ago, would that trigger like additional workup? Or do you think that most of the time, and people, you know, if a physician sees this, they go, look, it's rhabdo, it's confirmed to be rhabdo, I know how to treat rhabdo.
Yeah, I really prefer to I don't love the diagnosis of rhabdo. I see it a lot, and I find it to be an insufficient diagnosis. And so I always push my learners to characterize it more. Is it exertional or not? And convince me, right? And so what seeing a recurrent bout like this would do, before anything else, it would just prompt me to take a much more detailed history. I want to know exactly the details of the prior bout. I want to know exactly the details of the current bout. And I want to, you know, based on how proportionate or disproportionate I feel it is, you know, that would be the thing that would guide me towards pursuing further evaluation versus chalking it up to, yeah, you did something not smart again, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. Summer is here, and that means a lot of you are going to want to spend more time outside and less time on meal prep, all while staying on track with your nutrition. For many, a meal prep service like Factor can bridge that gap. Now, I've been using Factor for a while now, just here and there when I'm spending more time away from home or don't have time to cook, and it's made my day delicious and easy. Meals are ready in just 2 minutes, and they have everything from breakfast to dinner and even dessert. You can stay fueled with easy, nutritious options. They also have 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons. I am a creature of habit, but there's a lot of different stuff to choose from, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. So head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use code BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Now, Acorns is an investment platform, also have a bunch of educational tools on their website. I thought they had a pretty good product, so thought I would let them sponsor our podcast. They make it easy to automatically start saving and investing for the future. You don't actually need a lot of money or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can start with just your spare change. With Roundups, that's a program that they have to round up any purchase made from a linked account, debit or credit card, to the next dollar, and that goes into your retirement or investment account. They also have Acorns Early, which is an investment account for kids. And they recommend an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Head over to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. Hey guys, it's Jordan with Barbell Medicine. I wanted to take a second to talk about our new podcast sponsor, Mint Mobile. With big wireless providers, what you see is never what you get. Somewhere between the store and your first month's bill, the price you thought you were paying magically skyrockets. With Mint Mobile, you'll never have to worry about gotchas ever again, because when they say $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan, they mean it. There's no surprise monthly bills and unexpected overages. They have premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. And all plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/BBM. That's mintmobile.com/BBM. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/BBM. $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month, and this is limited to new customers on a first 3-month plan only. Speeds are slower above 40 gigabytes on the unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions may apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, fair enough. Well, let's give you some additional labs and see what you come up with. So she had a tox screen done that was negative. She had an autoimmune workup, which was also negative. She had a cortisol done at 9 a.m. in the morning. It was 16, and normal is 133 to 540. It was repeated, and it was 9. Her ACTH was undetectable. Normal range is 10 to 60. Her FSH and LH were both low. She had an MRI of her pituitary gland, which was normal. She had an ultrasound of the abdomen and pelvis, showed a nodular liver and moderate splenomegaly, and she had an anti-soluble liver antigen antibody, and IgG levels were both elevated. Blood cultures and other infectious workup were negative. So before I go any further, and again, if you're listening at home, with all that information, you might want to play that back again because that was a lot of information, particularly if you don't diagnose people regularly. You can come up with your own diagnosis. So Austin, any thoughts on those findings and maybe a final diagnosis here?
Okay, so some interesting findings here. I mean, the toxic and autoimmune kind of predisposing factors that I talked about earlier seems to have been ruled out. I'm trusting the comprehensiveness of that evaluation at this point. I might be not familiar with the particular test that was done to assess cortisol because that normal range is different than the one that I'm used to. But it seems like in that lab where they did that test, that patient's cortisol was very low early in the morning. And so that raises concern for something called adrenal insufficiency or not having enough cortisol being produced for whatever reason. And there are a lot of different reasons why that can happen. It can happen due to issues in the brain and the pituitary gland, or it could happen due to reasons in the adrenal gland itself. And the reasons why those can happen are, again, extensive and variable around the world and by population and things like that. So that's kind of my first initial signal here. And it could fit that if this patient does have some adrenal, some hormone related issue, again, there are buckets of muscle disorders that can, explain some of those things. More often, we think of myopathies emerging when people have too much cortisol for sustained long-term periods of time than too little. But again, these things often travel together with other disorders. And so there may be multiple things going on here. The ACTH being very low means that this patient has no signal going to their adrenal glands from their pituitary telling it to create cortisol. So this is kind of the opposite of the case that we had last time where the patient had way too high of ACTH. I believe they had Cushing's disease and that was stimulating their adrenals to make too much cortisol and they had the consequences of that. It does seem like they have generalized pituitary dysfunction for some reason because of their gonadotropins. The FSH and LH are very low. At the same time, especially in a 55-year-old woman who is presumably likely to be postmenopausal, where those hormones actually tend to go up. And so that's another bit of odd finding there. The MRI being normal is great, reassuring. No tumor, no stroke, no apoplexy, other sorts of things that can happen to the pituitary gland. Now, it's interesting what they found in the liver or why they even looked there in the first place, if it was just due to the quote unquote liver enzymes that were more likely from muscle, or if they had some other signal on the patient's original labs, like, low platelet count or some other findings that would suggest cirrhosis. But this patient has a nodular looking liver and an enlarged spleen. And the combination of those things raises suspicion for cirrhosis. And so patients who have cirrhosis, they can develop it for similarly a whole bunch of reasons. It can be toxic things, autoimmune things, infections, things like that. Now, when we pair findings of likely cirrhosis with this patient's soluble liver antigen and elevated IgG levels, and we have a middle-aged woman who has a history of other autoimmune disease like Hashimoto's thyroiditis, that all together starts to you know, coalesce into an autoimmune syndrome that is impacting her liver, and that antibody and IgG level can be suspicious for autoimmune hepatitis. And so that is something that I'm concerned is going on, at least to explain her her liver and spleen findings. So this patient has multiple autoimmune conditions. Now, how exactly that ties in to recurrent bouts of rhabdo, I actually don't know. That's something that perhaps you're going to educate us on here next. But that is what I am most concerned that this patient has, is a form of autoimmune hepatitis leading to cirrhosis based on those final findings.
Yeah. So she was diagnosed with adrenal insufficiency and autoimmune hepatitis. She was managed in the hospital with IV hydration and oral hydrocortisone. Her condition improved. Her CK went down and she regained the ability to walk in 2 weeks. She was discharged on hospital day 15 with home health and rehabilitation at home. So clinical pearls here. Also, good job. I would like to say that now I predicted that you got it right, and in fact you did, so I'm going to pat myself on the back. As far as some clinical pearls here, I wanted to talk about rhabdomyolysis, especially in the setting, as you mentioned, this was kind of unique with adrenal insufficiency, because as you mentioned on the last case that we did, when there was adrenal excess, so hypercortisolism, well, we know that that can cause myopathy, and it happens, unfortunately, pretty frequently with people who are on exogenous glucocorticoids for extended periods of time.
Yep.
But just to back up a little bit, rhabdomyolysis is a medical condition involving the rapid breakdown of damaged or injured skeletal muscle tissue, leading to the direct release of intracellular muscle contents. Now, clinically, rhabdomyolysis is characterized by the triad of myalgia, so muscle pain, muscle weakness, and then red to brown urine due to myoglobinuria, which just means you have myoglobin that carries around oxygen in the muscles, and that ends up in the urine. However, and I don't know why it's called the triad, and I think we've said this a number of times, like less than 10% of cases actually have this triad. So like, I don't know why we're still teaching that, but we learned it, and so you have to as well. We did a whole episode on rhabdomyolysis. That's episode 266. I've linked that in the show notes below. So as you pointed out earlier, and actually from the jump, you were like, look, if someone's got rhabdomyolysis and we don't have a clear cause for it, we probably should work that up just to figure out, like, make sure they don't have it again. And also, like, is there something that we can manage here? So yeah, as you kind of alluded to, there are a bunch of other potential causes. There are metabolic causes of rhabdomyolysis. There are mitochondrial disorders that can cause rhabdomyolysis. Sickle cell trait can lead to an increased risk of rhabdomyolysis. Medications, drugs, and endocrine disorders. In this particular case, cortisol deficiency. Now, it's interesting. Normally during exercise, cortisol, and we'll talk about this in the main part of this podcast, cortisol is primarily involved in making catecholamines, so that stuff like noradrenaline and adrenaline, which you need for your fight or flight sort of response, which happens during exercise, but also for energy liberation, so creating more glucose in the liver. So you break down glucose that you've stored in the liver and you make new glucose that helps support normal blood sugar levels, also supplies muscles with a bunch of extra glucose for function, also breaks down fatty acid, stored fat into free fatty acids that you can use, breaks down proteins, which you need, which results in an increase in the free amino acid pool. So you can do stuff with those things. Okay. But if you have adrenal insufficiency, which means you're not making as much cortisol, you get an impaired energy supply to the muscles. You get less glycogenolysis and gluconeogenesis in the liver, and the muscles themselves kind of get this ischemic sort of reaction. So you get a lot more muscle breakdown. There's also an interesting thing that happens with exercising muscles. They produce some tyrosine and this other metabolite, which we'll talk about later, that actually seems to inhibit sort of muscle breakdown in active muscle tissue, provided there's cortisol around. But if you don't have the cortisol around and the muscles are active, you actually get increased muscle breakdown. So not only are you, it's like a two-hit sort of thing. One, you get less energy to the muscles. And two, you get less sort of preservation of active muscles. So you get more muscle breakdown than you otherwise would. So it seems like she got it from both ends in this particular case. And it may have had a contribution from a hypothyroidism. I know you weren't really impressed with her TSH, but the case write-up did mention that. They're like, well, if she was insufficiently managed, we know that hypothyroidism, for example, can lead to increased muscle breakdown. Although for you, you're like, well, if she's sick, I would kind of expect that response.
Yeah, it wasn't quite bad enough for me.
The cause of the adrenal insufficiency is unfortunately unknown here. So we don't really have a satisfying answer, but it may be associated with the autoimmune hepatitis with that liver disease. Between this and she had a history of the Hashimoto's thyroiditis, an autoimmune thyroid condition, it may be related to this autoimmune polyglandular system, which there are multiple types and genetically related. Effectively, you got dealt the short end of the stick with respect to genetics, and you can get multiple autoimmune sort of conditions. More broadly, the autoimmune condition affecting the pituitary gland could be possible given the decrease in FSH and LH, like you mentioned, although there was nothing found on MRI, so plus or minus on that. It could be related to like a Sheehan syndrome, right? Like delayed. She did have a kid, you know, many, many years ago. That's like an ischemic attack on the pituitary gland during childbirth or around childbirth, but that would be pretty remote and kind of unusual to present, you know, decades later. There's also some case reports on rhabdomyolysis with the SSRI, that stands for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. She's on sertraline to manage her depression. There's an increase in rhabdomyolysis in those individuals, although it's relatively rare overall, but it has been reported. So hard to say. If I had to put my money on this, though, I'd probably say that autoimmune polyglandular sort of disease is probably most likely. And then the reason why she had rhabdo as a result of the adrenal insufficiency is basically because she had two mechanisms for increased muscle breakdown that you otherwise wouldn't see provided you had adequate cortisol. Whereas interestingly, if you have too much cortisol on board, well, you can get more muscle protein breakdown as well. So it's kind of, you want the right amount, not too much, not too little. It's like the Goldilocks sort of situation here.
Yeah, interesting. I'm upset at myself because I actually thought of the diagnosis of autoimmune polyglandular syndrome and didn't say it. And I would have sounded extra smart if I had actually said that when I thought it. The other thing I'll mention is that diagnosing adrenal insufficiency and cirrhosis is actually pretty complicated. And that's because those patients are not synthesizing cortisol binding globulin at the same level that they otherwise normally would. And so that complicates things in the same way that people might be aware of sex hormone binding globulin and how that impacts testosterone measurements and free T and total T and things like that. There's a cortisol binding globulin that binds and carries cortisol around. And when you're not making it because your liver is trashed, that can complicate the diagnosis here. So interesting case. Good find. Hopefully the people like it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.